the most important thing is the future. We don't know what's the future.
Since the war has started, there have been over 20 Palestinians killed in the course of the week alone. More homes have been demolished.
If it hadn't been for the work that was done at Fort Detrick, we wouldn't know that ciprofloxacin was good against this pathogen. So I would say that I don't know where it came from.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Tuesday, April 1st, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Iraq's information minister accuses U.S. forces of indiscriminately killing American citizens in Iraq as observers. Two high school teachers in Albuquerque are suspended for putting up student posters for and against the war. And a look at homeland insecurities, an investigative report on the who and the why of the anthrax attack in the U.S. Those stories and more on tonight's Peace Watch, but first, these news headlines.
With headlines for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jonaki Lafis. Heavy fighting continues near Karbala, where Iraqi Republican Guard forces have been massing. In the north, heavy bombing was reported in Kirkuk, a center of Iraq's oil industry. The New York Times reports U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell is headed for Europe to talk with leaders who have said they may not greet him with open arms. Donald Rumsfeld continues to draw criticism from field commanders for not sending enough resources to fight an effective ground war. Iraqi Information Minister Mohammed Saeed El-Sahaf, at a press conference today, has accused U.S. warplanes of attacking two buses carrying American and European human shields on a highway between Baghdad and Amman. U.S. officials have dismissed the allegations. In the meantime, another missile has been fired into Kuwait. Ula Farawati reports from Dubai.
Another missile was fired at Kuwait from southern Iraq. The missile was shot down by a Kuwaiti Patriot missile battery before it reached Kuwait. Sirens have been sounded in Kuwait City, warning of what appeared to be at least the 17th missile that Iraq has fired at Kuwait since the start of the U.S. military invasion of Iraq on March 20. This is the first such attack on Kuwait since the missile hit a shopping center in Kuwait City on Saturday. However, it was found out later that that missile was actually an American cruise missile inadvertently fired at Kuwait from the Persian Gulf. Kuwait served as the main launch pad for the U.S.-led war on Iraq, with thousands of coalition troops stationed there. In Dubai, the United Arab Emirates, this is Ola Farawati for Free Speech Radio News.
The UN Secretary General Kofi Annan seems to be under increasing pressure from the Arab nations seeking to convene a UN General Assembly session to discuss the U.S. war on Iraq. Heather Risby reports from the United Nations.
Kofi Annan said today the Arab nations were calling for a General Assembly meeting, but added he was not sure if there would be discussion at this stage or not. The UN chief has been under fire from a number of countries for his apparently weak stance on the U.S. war against Iraq. Yesterday, Mahathir Mohamad, the Malaysian Prime Minister, who is also head of the 116-member non-aligned movement, demanded the resignation of Kofi Annan, saying that the UN chief has failed to be reflective of the opinions of the United Nations. In response to a question, Annan said today he was aware that there was lots of unhappiness at the UN about the war. Observers say, despite overwhelming opposition to war, the UN member states have failed to convene a General Assembly session because many of them are facing tremendous pressure from the United States against such move. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Risby at the United Nations.
One of the nation's most outspoken Somali advocates was arrested yesterday on charges of filing false immigration documents 5 years ago. Chip Mitchell reports from St. Paul.
Immigration authorities took Omar Jamal to U.S. District Court to answer a 6-count indictment by a Tennessee grand jury. They say Jamal's 1998 asylum application in Memphis was fraudulent because it indicated he hadn't lived in any other countries after fleeing Somalia. Apart from the criminal charges, the Bureau of Immigration and Customs Enforcement is detaining him under a $10,000 bond. After moving to Minnesota in 1999, Jamal founded the Somali Justice Advocacy Center. An immigration spokesperson denied that Jamal's work affected the case. He could face prison time, large fines, and deportation. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Chip Mitchell in St. Paul.
Citizens who attended public hearings across the country yesterday say the Environmental Protection Agency wants to make it easier for old power plants to keep polluting. Many object to Bush administration changes to a law they call the foundation of the Federal Clean Air Act. From Houston, Texas, Erica McDonald has the report.
Wearing cowboy hats and calling themselves the Clean Air Rangers, 200 citizens attended a Dallas public hearing to weigh in on changes to the EPA's New Source Review Program. The changes would allow old power plants to make adjustments that increase pollution without applying for federal permits. Administration officials say the measure would save money. Environmentalists say the change is another Bush rollback that benefits industry at the cost of public health. Hilton Kelly, a resident of Port Arthur, a Texas community skirted by power plants, called Bush administration changes environmental racism.
We are dying from the gases you are putting into our air. We are dying a slow death. We know what's going on in the Middle East at this time, but when it happens over there and someone drops a gas bomb, it's intentional. In our community, it's intentional as well, and people are dying.
Public comment for the New Source Review change closes May 2nd. From KPFT in Houston, I'm Erica McDonald for Free Speech Radio News.
From Community Radio KGNU in Boulder, Colorado, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jonicky LaFeese.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. This invasion into Iraq by the Bush administration and its ally Britain has been promoted as a mission to liberate the people of Iraq from the evil regime of Saddam Hussein. I don't think anybody disagrees that Saddam Hussein is a tyrannical dictator who has not acted in the best interests of the Iraqi people and needs to be removed, but the question becomes how? Is invasion of a sovereign nation the appropriate way to effect a regime change? Joining us on the phone lines from Indiana for this discussion is Janib Istrabadi, Associate Director of the Middle Eastern and Islamic Studies Program at Indiana University, Bloomington. Istrabadi is an Iraqi-American. Our second guest on the phone line is Lamise Adoni, a visiting professor of journalism at the University of Southern Cal in Berkeley. She's an independent journalist and an analyst of Middle East media for over two decades. She has family currently living in Basra, Iraq, and lived in Iraq for over a decade. Lamise is currently living in California. Good afternoon, women.
Yes, hi. I didn't live in Iraq. I covered Iraq for over a decade as a journalist.
Okay. Thank you, Lamise.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon.
We've invited the two of you to get your reactions to the invasion of Iraq as it unfolds before us and plans for governing Iraq in the aftermath of the war. The British newspaper The Guardian is reporting today that in the Bush administration's secret plan for post-Saddam Iraq, the government will consist of 23 ministries, each headed by an American. And every ministry will have four Iraqi advisors appointed by the Americans. Is it fair to say that either of you support the war, but both are in favor of regime change?
Lamise, would you like to go first?
No, Regina, first.
Okay. Lamise? Well, Lamise, you've covered the Middle East as a journalist, and you live there and have family.
Regime change has been defined by the American administration as a function of its own hegemony in the region and elsewhere. So I don't prefer to use these words, but whether I would like to see a better government in Iraq, of course I would. And whether I would like to see a representative government in Iraq, that will be extremely important for the Iraqi people as well as for the whole region. And that also applies to other regimes in the region. But for the U.S. to start its own doctrine between quotes of regime change, meaning that it would change regimes, not because whether they're democratic or not, but whether they accommodate its policies and how it perceives their role in the region according to its own interests, that's unacceptable. That has nothing to do with self-determination and the people's right to choose. That has to do with an exercise of power.
Zanib, you're an Iraqi-American. Do you support this type of what some might call an imperialistic rule for Iraq?
Absolutely not. I want to make it really clear that up to the last minute, I was hoping that war would not break out, that some solution, to the crisis that was precipitated by the United States would come about. In fact, Although I want to also make it clear that I have problems with the peace movement. I did not go to any of the demonstrations except on that Wednesday when I agonized for 50 minutes.
Why not?
Well, because from what I've seen, at least on television, you know, I'm in a small town, a small university town, and when I've passed by the weekly demonstrations here in Bloomington, I see that there are signs calling, of course, for peace and no war. There are signs denouncing President Bush, which I don't have a problem with. There are signs demanding freedom for the Palestinians, which, of course, I don't have a problem with. Signs for freedom for Haiti, for freedom of, you know, all sorts of people.
It sounds like there's some signs you're not seeing that you'd like to see.
That's exactly what I'm getting at. I don't see any signs calling for, you know, down with Saddam. Saddam is a tyrant. Saddam and Bush are equivalent. Freedom for the Iraqi people, nothing of the nature. And so this is why I have not been able to go to any of the peace demonstrations or the peace rallies. So I do have a problem with the peace movement. I see a lack of consistency here. And unfortunately, the Iraqi people are between the proverbial, you know, rock and hard place, have no champions. Their own government has tyrannized over them. The American government has tyrannized over them. And it's in a, you're going to ask me, well, what's the solution? Frankly, I don't have one. I cannot think of a single people who have been sort of abandoned to the wind like this.
Let me ask both of you. The architects of this war have ensured the American public that they will do everything possible to protect the lives of innocent civilians. Yet, we're seeing an increasing, disturbing amount of reports of civilians being killed in this war. Last week, two open-air markets were bombed in Baghdad. Senior British military officers on the ground are making it clear they're appalled by reports over the weekend that U.S. Marines killed Iraqi civilians. And today's Washington Post reports 10 civilians were killed instantly when the U.S. Army's 3rd Infantry Division fired a 25-millimeter cannon on a truck that they were in. Five children under the age of five were killed instantly. Now, many people that favor this war say freedom is not free and that lives will be lost. Clearly, the U.S. troops are not targeting civilians, yet civilian lives are being lost. Is it worth it to rid the country of the likes of Saddam Hussein, in your opinion, Zanib or Lamise?
Well, again, we go back to the objectives of this war. Ridding Saddam Hussein of the country, I mean, many people in Iraq, in the opposition in Iraq, in the 70s and 80s and 90s, gave their life, especially in the late 70s and early 80s, when Saddam cracked down on all dissent, even inside the Ba'ath movement. They gave their life for a more representative Iraqi government. They ended up either in jail or were killed, assassinated, or tortured to death, or in exile, and the U.S. was then supporting Saddam Hussein. So it's people in Iraq have already given their life for and will continue to struggle for their freedom. However,
very quickly, please, very quickly.
When you're talking about an invasion by the U.S., which by leaders who have a very different agenda, you can. I think that the lives that are being lost are not being lost because of a liberation of
all
Iraq.
Right. Lamise Adoni, a visiting professor of journalism at the University of Southern Cal, and we were also joined by Zanib Istrabadi, the associate director of the Middle Eastern and Islamic Studies program. Thank you both for being our guests this evening on Peace Watch.
Thank you.
Bye, Zainab. Bye.
Peace rallies and prayer vigils continue to take place around the country and the world despite the fact that the war is fully underway. Hundreds of thousands and maybe even millions have marched and engaged in acts of civil disobedience in opposition to the invasion of Iraq. Peace advocates are not limited to radical students, but even some from mainstream America. The Pope is actually against this war. They're actually speaking out against the war. Voices of dissent, however, are rarely seen in major media outlets, and if the story is covered at all, it's marginalized and or buried deep in local and national papers. To gain insight into what drives these editorial decisions, we've invited journalist and author David Brock to explore why voices of dissent are not equitably portrayed in the media. Brock is author of Blinded by the Right, The Conscience of an Ex-Conservative, and was referred to as a, quote, notorious right-wing hitman, unquote. And that's a statement from your own book jacket, David. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
David, you spent a number of years writing for the Washington Times newspaper, the New York Times, the Washington Post op-ed pages, and Rolling Stone, and among other publications. Does it surprise you that the peace movement doesn't get exactly equal time with the conservative government line that this war is a necessary evil?
No, I don't think it's surprising at all. And I think that that's because the media in this country for quite some time has been under conservative domination. And what I mean by that is you have an extremely bellicose right-wing media that is largely right-wing talk radio, but also the
knows
Fox News channel.
The media is liberal.
That is a myth that the conservatives have manufactured. They've spent millions of dollars to convince people of that. I think that's a rhetorical trick that paves the way for their infiltration of the mainstream media, and that argument also builds up their right-wing audience. But I think it's false.
So you're saying,
and the evidence is with us now. We're in a war. You know, people don't have to take my word for it. The Washington Post ombudsman, Andrea Mitchell, other people in mainstream journalism have conceded that the press did a very poor job in covering voices of dissent and opposition to the war going back to last summer, going back to last fall, before Congress voted. And that's when it really counted. That's when four generals, retired generals, testified about their reticence about this war on Capitol Hill, and it wasn't covered in the Washington Post.
The role of the media is to inform. How is the public interest served if the media is acting more or less as a cheerleader for the administration's policy? And I would ask you to address also the fact that some of the mainstream reporters have actually participated in something called being embedded, which means they are traveling with the U.S. military, the military that they're supposed to be objectively covering and reporting on.
Right. Well, you know, I think the main thing is that this administration has been extremely effective up to a point in controlling the news. And you have to ask yourself why that is. I don't think it's necessarily that they're public relations geniuses. I think that a climate was set, and you have to go back to after 9/11. A climate was set. Then conservative groups targeted mainstream anchors, producers, in a strategy to question their patriotism if they did their jobs. And so we had a very docile press, partly as a result of that right-wing campaign. And now, as you mentioned, it's coming back to haunt them a bit because now there is some skepticism in the press. Now we're seeing through the embedded journalists what is really going on there. And of course, the conservative attack machine is now attacking these reporters for doing their job. Well, the fact is they set up these expectations. They set up the idea that this would be a cakewalk. This is what we heard, and not so much from the administration, from their surrogates in the media. Those were false hopes, as everyone can see now.
In your book, you write that the media has been co-opted by the right wing. Can you expound on that?
Sure, yeah. For 30 years, the conservative movement, and if you add it all up, they've spent more than $1 billion on a communications infrastructure. It includes the think tanks, the advocacy groups, their subsidized publications. That is an apparatus that operates no matter who's in power, who isn't in power. It forces us to discuss public issues on their terms. That's been a very organized effort. It's been very successful. And there's really nothing to counter it on the other side.
So many people, and some very prominent or famous or people of note, have spoken out against this war and have been painted as unpatriotic. The Dixie Chicks, for example, Sean Penn, actor Danny Glover, U.S. Representative Barbara Lee, just to name a few. How is it that, I mean, has the entire country decided to tilt to the right? Or how is it that so many Americans seem to be against this war and those that dare to speak up are somehow blasted?
Well, I think it's basically like this. The voices that you're talking about, the voices that are characterizing dissent as unpatriotic, they are the loudest voices. I feel that the right wing produces a lot of noise. I don't believe, and if you look at the polls, it doesn't reflect the reality of the country. The problem is that where real people stand in this country isn't reflected in the media, and it's impossible to have all that noise coming out of the conservative movement day in and day out and not have it seep into the rest of the conversation. And I think that's what's happened. It's almost a process of brainwashing. And that's where this relentless stigmatizing of people is concerned. And in that environment, it's very difficult to stand up and oppose this government. The people who do it are targeted in the way they have been. And that's dangerous.
David Brock, author of Blinded by the Right, The Conscience of an Ex-Conservative. And so you were one of those, David, at one point.
That's right. I know what I'm talking about.
Okay. Thank you, David. As bombs continue to rain over Baghdad and across Iraq, a nation that was already crippled by 12 years of economic sanctions is continuing to suffer. Independent journalist Mei Ying Welsh recently visited the city of Mosul in northern Iraq to gauge what people there think about the war. She files this report.
The town of Mosul in northern Iraq doesn't look like a city in the midst of war. This peaceful place, where the old, new, and even the ancient coexist, is one of the wealthiest in Iraq. In the midst of this spring season, families pack the narrow streets to buy sweets, toys, and new clothes for their children. But the happy scene belies a sobering reality, for Mosul is the northern capital of a country living in a state of siege for over 20 years. Even as they contemplate war, the people of Mosul gather in the streets to honor those whom they call the martyrs, soldiers who fell in the 8-year war with Iran, what some call the Third World's first great war. Between 1980 and 1988, Iraq lost 500,000 sons, a scar on the national consciousness, which sent the nation deeply into debt. Then came the 1991 Gulf War, a conflict which devastated the country's infrastructure, knocking out factories, electricity grids, sewage and water systems, and causing the deaths, according to U.S. Census figures, of over 70,000 civilians. Mosul is also located in one of the two no-fly zones imposed after the Gulf War. Every day, British and American jets patrol the skies over the city, often bombing military and civilian sites, such as this Mosul elementary school, which was accidentally hit in 1999. And finally, there is the blow Iraqis consider the most devastating of all, the UN economic sanctions imposed in 1990 after Iraq's invasion of Kuwait, and which continue today. Dr. Raad Tolha is on the front lines of a daily battle against the effects of these sanctions, of what Iraqis call the hisar, the siege. As director of Mosul's General Hospital, every day Dr. Raad oversees a system that lacks the medical staff and supplies it needs to fight disease. Dr. Raad's hospital has the only respiratory care unit in northern Iraq, but they don't have enough ventilators for all the patients. The pediatric ward lacks sufficient incubators. The coronary care unit lacks a station monitor, and life-saving drugs are often not available.
Now we don't have Xylocaine. Xylocaine will save his life.
Since the UN Oil for Food program began in 1996, Iraq is able to sell its oil for humanitarian supplies such as food and medicine, and the situation in hospitals has improved. But with a full quarter of all funds diverted to pay reparations to Kuwait, and in the current climate of potential war, international buyers are wary of Iraqi oil, and the program is struggling. Dr. Raad says facing patients without the tools to give them proper care is a daily, heartbreaking routine. Additionally, he says 80% of the patients they see are malnourished. These twins, Khalid and Ahlam, are suffering from malnutrition, diarrhea, and cold.
Because of the low birth weight, there is no fat under the skin, so the child is susceptible to be cold. The child in this bed needs a hydrator, not available at all. So we depend on the clothes, on a hot water bottle beside the baby.
Low salaries due to hyperinflation of as little as $10 a month have led to a shortage of doctors and nurses. Medical students without access to new textbooks learn from professors whose knowledge is out of date. The hospital only has one working elevator, so Dr. Rod takes the stairs.
That one, the emergency unit, we receive the patient, acute patient cases, down, and then the patient receives the treatment.
Here in the upper floors, he finds worried relatives crowding the waiting rooms.
They know that we have a shortage of nurses. They know we have shortage of beds, shortage of drugs, shortage of equipment. So they are worried all the time.
Dr. Rod says all the stress takes an enormous toll. After work each day, Dr. Rod Hello. Goes to visit his mother and brother's family.
This is my grandfather's house on the left, and this is my father's house, and this is my mother on the door.
But it is not a chance to relax. In 1986, Dr. Rod lost his older brother, also a doctor, who disappeared at age 25 in a battle of the Iran-Iraq War. His mother, who believes he is still alive and living as a prisoner in Iran, has been waiting for him to come home for nearly 20 years.
They said he is lost, but we don't know. So we go to the front looking for the dead persons. We didn't find him, and we are waiting for him.
But there is one special person who will never come home. Dr. Rod's twin brother, Maud, died in a car accident after the Gulf War. Dr. Rod is responsible for the widow, two daughters, and son his twin brother left behind. Perhaps most precious to Dr. Rod, his brother's son, Ali, who was born in the middle of an air raid during Desert Storm.
We gathered all here in this house, in the underground, and we suffered a lot of during that time. The whole Iraq is bombed. We didn't see airplanes, but we only hear the sounds. There was no water to bath. There was no electricity. His mother was here, pregnant with him, starting abdominal pain, contraction. We took her to the hospital, and we took him in the blanket. And it was dark. I remember I held him, and I will nearly to fall on the stairs.
When asked how they feel about a new war with the United States, Dr. Rod is clear.
Every human being, the first need is air, second is food, third is security. We are lacking security.
The sanctions affect us in everything. For example, in the street, the sewage system, and the most important thing is the future. We don't know. What's the future? What will happen after, for example, 2 days, 3 days, 1 week? Always worry. Yes, we are happy. We're trying to be happy.
After a long day, Dr. Rod finally arrives home.
Hello.
This is his sanctuary. A warm place where he can unwind and relax among the people he loves.
My daughter.
Children still study under the jets. Hospitals are in crisis. Brothers now lost. Sons who never came home.
We hope we see the peace in the future.
Mei Ying Welsh, Free Speech TV, Mosul, Iraq.
CNN.com is reporting today that Iraq's foreign information minister accused U.S. forces today of indiscriminately killing their own citizens in a bus attack and killing 9 Iraqi children in a central neighborhood of Bablan. Yesterday, an American warplane attacked 2 buses on the highway between Baghdad and Amman. Mohammed Saeed al-Shahaf told reporters, "Those people on those 2 buses are human shields coming to participate in defending civilian installations like water sanitation stations, electricity generation stations, and so on," he said. Shahaf said, "The brave Americans start shooting the Americans in the buses. They are indiscriminately killing people." That's according to CNN.com. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.
When you can't believe they say, and you're haunted by the swords they raise. Like a rabid dog we've seen before, they refuse to hear the world pounding down their door. We don't want your war. Let's all yell a little louder now. We don't want your war.